Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. From the beginning of our country's independence, reparations have taken place. The goal, to right the wrongs of gross violations of human rights, which often involves compensation to communities and individuals who suffered these atrocities. Most notably, this has taken place with Native American and Indigenous communities, as well as Japanese Americans who suffered internment during World War II. For years, the conversation and the debate has also centered on African Americans and reparations for slavery. California embarked on a first-in-the-nation task force studying the effects of slavery and systemic racism, with the goal of making amends symbolically with a formal apology and also through compensation by ways of potentially individual payments and long-term community investments. All of this is still being worked out. The Reparations Task Force first met last summer, kicking off a two-year process. This week, a significant development took place surrounding who would be eligible. Lil Kalish is a reporter for the nonprofit CalMatters and joins us to share their reporting. Lil, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
California, as we just mentioned, or I just mentioned, it's the first in the nation to embark on something like this. But as you remind us in your reporting, the state joined the union as a free state under the Compromise of 1850. Why does California feel the responsibility to be the first to take this on? If you can just remind us about the arguments that were made that led to this becoming signed into law.
Yeah, so even though California was a free state, they also enacted the Fugitive Slave Law. So if there were enslaved people that were brought to California, they still remained enslaved. And California also feels the reverberance of the long-term effects of slavery. So there's redlining, there's continued discrimination. There, you know, we have one of the largest prison systems. So California feels a responsibility to kind of try to right those wrongs as best as they can through this task force.
Who is the task force?
So the task force is a group of 9 individuals, includes civil rights lawyers, psychologists, politicians, including Assemblymember Sawyer Jones and State Senator Bradford, and academics. And over the next 2 years, they're going to all together develop and plan a proposal for what reparations might look like.
Before we dive into the latest development, I'm curious what stands out to you about these meetings and discussions or even debates that have been taking place over the past 10 months.
Yeah, so especially Tuesday's meeting, it was a deeply emotional, you know, all-day marathon about, you know, how does the state atone for this nationwide atrocity and who exactly should benefit from that? They were pretty deeply divided. There are basically 2 camps. Some people wanted to restrict reparations solely to the descendants of enslaved people, which really sticks to the language of the original bill, AB 3121, which gives a special consideration to Black Californians who are direct descendants. And other folks took a more broad approach, saying that like reparations shouldn't just be for addressing past harms, but it should also address the present harms and preventing future ones. And for example, Lisa Holder, a civil rights attorney, said in last month's meeting that, you know, it's a collective harm that should collectively be addressed.
Yeah. What was decided this week?
Well, it was decided, a 5-4 vote, that reparations will only be given to Black folks in California that can establish a direct lineage to enslaved ancestors or are descendants of free Black person living in the U.S. before the 19th century, which just effectively means that it will exclude Black immigrants that came to the U.S. after 1865 when slavery was abolished.
How many Black Californians are there in the state?
So in the state, there are Black folks make up around 6.5% of the state's population, so roughly 2.6 million people. But Black people are overrepresented in the state's jails and prisons and make up around 40% of the state's unhoused population.
You touched upon one of the arguments that was made, against just having a direct lineage to slavery. I mean, if the goal, I mean, you're talking about the prison system. I mean, if the goal is to repair historical systemic harm, what arguments were made in terms of like, shouldn't that apply to all Black Californians and not only those who were direct descendants of slavery?
Yeah. And essentially, so Lisa Holder, like I said it's a harm that should be collectively addressed. Other folks were saying that, you know, if you only had such a narrow understanding of reparations, it would be another win for white supremacy. There's also the question of how do you prove that lineage? It's going to be difficult. Not everybody has access to, you know, resources like databases or DNA testings. And some people don't want to do that. They brought in a genealogist who cautioned against, you know, who said doing that genealogy work is important, but it's also potentially invasive, mm-hmm. costly, and time consuming, and not something that everyone will be able to access.
Right. You mentioned also it was a 5-4 split vote. I mean, that's pretty close.
Yes.
I guess what, if you can kind of elaborate more on what the overall arguments in support or against determining eligibility, perhaps how about in support of this?
Yeah, in support. So the chairperson, Camilla Moore, said that not going with a lineage-based approach would really aggrieve the victims of slavery. And I will say that the vote, it came after a proposed amendment to the motion, which would have expanded reparations to all 2.6 million Black folks in California. And that failed. And so then they moved on to this next motion, which kind of more narrowly defined it. I think one of the people on the task force, who's Don Tamaki, the only non-Black person on the force, he's Japanese American, and he was involved in the Japanese American redress movement. He shared with the task force that they faced very similar deliberations when trying to decide how California was going to restitute Japanese Americans, and said, you know, it's rough justice, basically, and you have to, not everybody will be included, but you have to kind of narrow it down to make it a bit more clear.
Is there an estimate of the 2.6 million African Americans in the state that would stand to benefit from this in terms of eligibility?
I don't know at this point.
Yeah. I mean, there's still so much that needs to be worked out, especially, I mean, how would you prove lineage? I mean, family lineage can be a difficult process. What kind of challenges will those who are interested run up against?
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, looking at census records or looking at, you know, archival data. And for example, in my family, I can only trace back to my great grandmother. I don't know who my great great grandparents were. I mean, I can assume that they were enslaved, but it would be a very costly and time-consuming process for me to go through that. It might involve a DNA test. It might involve visiting archives. And that's something that I think, you know, low-income Black folks will bear the brunt of if they aren't able to do that. And some genealogists that were testifying Tuesday also said that they should have resources available. Like, if that is the method that we're going to go through in the state, there should be resources made available so that it can be accessible to everyone.
Right, because that just raises, like, equity red flags. I mean, access to internet, I mean, individuals who have disabilities, even just a savviness. I mean, you're a journalist, like, you know how to navigate the process probably better than a lot of other people. I mean, for a pretty arduous task,
right.
You know, going back, you know, more than a century for family lineage.
Exactly.
One quote that I'd like a little bit more information on. It was from the dean of UC Berkeley's law school, and they testified in favor of establishing lineage, which was decided upon, but in a race-neutral fashion. What exactly does that mean, and what is the benefit of that?
So that's basically saying that it's better to not establish reparations solely based on race, because that's more likely to get struck down in courts. If you do it based on lineage, it's kind of, you have the burden of proof. You have this direct lineage that you can map out, and that will be less likely to be taken up in the courts.
That makes sense. Given that we're 10 months into a two-year process, is there a potential that this could be appealed, or does this vote essentially set eligibility in stone?
That I actually don't know, but I do know that this vote will help the economists that are now tasked with kind of figuring out the scope of reparations. While we still don't know what the reparations will look like, as you said earlier, it could look like monetary payments, it could look like free college, it could look like housing grants or housing assistance, grants for businesses, but there's a lot of unknowns still yet to be determined.
Yeah, especially, I mean, this is the first in a nation task force that's embarking on this. You mentioned that one of the task force members, they were part of Japanese Americans and the redress reparations. In 1988, obviously President Reagan, he signed a bill for reparations for Japanese Americans, $20,000 and a formal apology. Is this or other past historical reparations are they being used as a template?
I think that Don Tamaki's work on the Japanese-American redress movement is being maybe not used as a template, but as kind of like a guiding force. You know, like, this is an example of how we've done this before. Let me bring in my knowledge to show how we can, you know, make these practical and difficult decisions going forward.
Yeah. From your reporting or from listening to public comment and the debate that's taking place, have there been learning lessons from past reparations?
It seems like, I don't know. I still don't know. It seems like it's really hard to compare these different instances of reparations, because chattel slavery is a very large and continuously harmful event in our country's history. So it seems like, yeah, I mean, there's been other reparations movements, like in South Africa and other countries around the world, that have been referenced in the testimonies. But I think this is such a specific issue to our nation that, it feels like this is kind of a first step forward.
Right. And we're still relatively early in this process. What are the next steps for the task force?
Yeah. So like I said earlier, the task force is now going to send that vote. They're going to share that eligibility determination with economists who were kind of trying to quantify the amount and the scope of the reparations. And by next summer, the task force will finish a report, which will detail, you know, more clearly for everybody who should receive reparations, in what form, what amount, and then that's off to the legislature to kind of take that to vote.
Lil, thank you for unpacking all of that and updating us on your reporting.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Lil Kalish is a reporter for the nonprofit CalMatters, updating us on the latest developments surrounding the California Reparations Task Force and eligibility for African Americans. Up next, on Cesar Chavez Day, we honor the late civil rights activist legacy, my conversation with his son, Paul Chavez. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Cesar Chavez would be 95 years old today. The labor leader and civil rights activist passed away nearly 30 years ago, but his legacy continues on decades later. He and his activist partner, Dolores Huerta, who is as active as ever to this very day, founded the National Farm Workers Association, which later became the United Farm Workers, still in existence to this very day. Chavez is buried next to his wife, Helen, in Kern County at the Cesar Chavez National Monument. Leading with nonviolence, Chavez is known for his tireless fight for farm worker rights in the form of boycotts, protests, strikes, and fasts that would last for weeks. But he was also a father, 8 children, and now dozens of grandchildren. In honor of Cesar Chavez Day, I spoke with Paul Chavez, the son of the late civil rights activist, who now heads the Cesar Chavez Foundation in the town of Keene in Kern County.
So, Mr. Chavez, in the history books, your father, Cesar Chavez, was a tireless fighter for farm workers, but to you and your siblings, he was dad. How do you celebrate his birthday?
You know, growing up, we realized from an early age that things were a little bit different in our household. And we learned at an early age that, you know, we learned that we needed to share him with other people that were looking for his attention and support. So, you know, he was busy. There was many events that he didn't attend. You know, he didn't go to our little league baseball games and things like that. But he made sure that his work was big enough that it can include us. And so while we didn't, you know, play baseball in the park, we marched on picket lines and went to union conventions and those kind of things. So he was pretty clever about how he made sure that his work was big enough for his kids.
Yeah. How was he as a father? I would imagine there were a decent amount of road trips.
Well, he was on the road all the time. And, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, my dad, pretty, you know, liberal progressive guy, but he was also that traditional father that, you know, that if my sisters were going out, wanted a chaperone, wanted them home at a certain time, maybe he was home, he would make sure they got home in time. He made sure that we did our chores around the house, and if we were going to work, we worked with gusto. So he was kind of old fashioned in that sense, that you have responsibilities and you got to work and you got to, you know, and you got to make sure that you follow the rules. So, you know, that's how he treated us as kids, but also he really exposed us to a lot of things that we wouldn't have otherwise been exposed to, like the plight of farm workers, but it was more than that, the plight of other groups. And so it was a good, well-balanced upbringing.
An important part of the equation in your family is your mother, Helen Fabela Chavez. They were high school sweethearts and they laid to rest side by side. She also played a really pivotal role in your father's success. What did you learn from your mother and their marriage?
Well, listen, my mother was one tough woman. You know, it's important. I'm glad that you mentioned her because many times we forget to talk about her contribution. You know, my mother's background was similar to my father's. You know, they were Mexican Americans, Chicanos growing up, you know, in California. My dad was from Yuma. My mom was from the Imperial Valley, and they ended up in Delano. And because of the brutality of agribusiness, they both had to drop out of school to help support their families. And so they weren't able to continue their education because of that. You know, when they met and they dated and they ended up getting married, like many people, their goal was to get out of the fields. You know, whenever people work in tough jobs, whether it's the fields or the steel mills or auto factories, everybody wants to get out of that, and they surely want their kids to do something else. And so it wasn't any different for my mom and dad. But you know, my dad would talk about how, or my mother would say, I take that back, would talk about how my dad would travel up and down the state when he was a community organizer. And he would always say, you know, I saw people working in the fields in terrible conditions. They were bent over using the short handle hoe. Somebody should do something about this. Somebody should do something about this. And after about 3 or 4 years, my mother, being a woman of few words, but a really strong character, said, why don't you do something about it? And then he still, you know, then began to talk, and he says, you know, if I did that, we're going to go back. There will be no salary. There'll be, you know, we're going to give up the most comfortable life we've ever had. We don't have to worry about a paycheck. You know, we don't worry about where the next bill's coming from. You know, they were squarely middle class. My dad was driving the Volvo in the late 50s. Right. And so they made a decision to give all that up and to go back to Delano and to settle a score that both of them felt needed to be addressed. And my mother, you know, when my dad first went out and began talking to workers, my mother continued to work, and she gave him gas money to get up and down the state to talk to farm workers. She took care of of a young family of 8 kids. And she was always there, you know, I remember the old mimeograph machines in our house, cranking the old mimeograph machines to make sure there was leaflets. And then she worked full time for many years. She ran a credit union, and she was a key part of the work. You know, another thing that I do want to mention is that in 1965, when there was a debate about whether the National Farm Workers Association, which was my father's union, mostly Latino organization, should join the Filipino AWOC that had gone out on strike. And there was debates going back and forth. And after some of that debate, my mother got up and basically said, are we a union or not? And called the question. And so my mother was very strong. She lived, a life full of a lot of struggles, but it was a life that she chose because she understood what it meant to be a farm worker and to have your dreams dashed.
Your parents were making these decisions as adults and you were witnessing it as a child. What did those sacrifices teach you? How did it shape you as a person?
Well, you know, I think that the first lesson that I learned was a lesson of being of service. I saw my father out there and putting his life on the line, and you know, there was times that he had to fast, and there was marches, and he basically stood behind his words, his actions did. And so I think it was that example of that, you know, that if you're going to do this work, it's got to be more than providing service. You got to be a servant. And so, you know, we've worked very hard to keep the work alive. He had this idea that farm workers just weren't farm workers, that workers just aren't workers, that after a long, hard day's work in the fields, that people go home to a whole different set of problems. Lack of access, you know, lack of access to affordable housing and quality medical care and consumer credit. And so the work that I do with the Cesar Chavez Foundation addresses those community needs that working people have.
You mentioned the fact that your father would fast and protest. Those would last for weeks. You were a child during that time. How was that for you? How do you reflect on that period?
Well, you know, he had three major fasts, and the first two fasts, I was a young boy, and you don't really understand what's going on. But his last fast in 1988, which is his longest fast, it was 36 days long. By then, I was working full time with him. I've been working full time for many years, and it was a tough experience, you know. Here's a man that you love and you respect, and you see him always full of vigor and out there talking to workers and just, you know, keeping this relentless pace, day by day becoming weaker and weaker because of the lack of nourishment. And I remember seeing him going through different phases where, there's a point where your senses become heightened, and if the light is too bright, it hurts your eyes, and if people are loud, it hurt your ears. And so he was in a lot of pain. And I just remember sitting there thinking, well, what can I do to take some of that pain from him? Because it was a difficult situation. But, you know, but the power of a fast is incredible, because what it does is it gets people to look at their own actions. And you sit there and you say, if this person's willing to make this kind of sacrifice, what are you willing to do? It was difficult because I couldn't do anything to relieve his pain. But what it did do is it allowed me to take a look at my own convictions and to go about my work with renewed vigor.
I mean, obviously, clearly the work was serious. Were there times where did you make your dad laugh or play full times with your father?
I probably made him more angry than laughing. But yeah, you know, my dad was, as a father, he was very cariñoso, as we say in Spanish. He was very loving and affectionate, and he had nicknames for everybody. And if you didn't have a nickname, he would give you a nickname. And so, you know, he was a lot of fun to be around. You know, some of the things that I remember about my dad, apart from the union work, was for him, the holidays, Christmas and Easter, were big days. People would get together, and during Easter, there were family softball games, and he would be the pitcher for both teams because he wanted to make sure that he won, he said. And, you know, during Christmas, people would gather in the small little house that him and my mother lived in, and he loved handing out presents, right, acting like Santa Claus. And so those things come to mind. He loved to play handball. He was a good handball player. And I can remember traveling with him up and down the state, and he seemed like he knew where every handball court was at. And he would pull over and he would challenge youngsters, right, to game of handball. And nothing gave him more pleasure than having us youngsters run around chasing the ball and him controlling center court.
Yeah, I can imagine. We're all aware that his labor partner was Dolores Huerta. The two founded what would eventually become the United Farm Workers Labor Union. And it can really be easy to take for granted what they accomplished during that time. What do you remember about their dynamic?
Well, you know, they really fed off of each other. You know, I think that that Dolores would keep my dad honest, and if she thought that there was a better way to get things done, she was, you know, she wouldn't back down. And I know that he had total confidence in her. And so they were able to exchange their positions without fear that somebody would be hurt and that they would go away. Their relationship was an enduring and lasting relationship. And so I think there was that combination of being able to be completely honest with each other that gave them the strength to handle a lot of issues that came up during their work lives.
Her foundation is located not too far from Cesar Chavez's foundation in Bakersfield. Do you ever see her or spend time with her to this day?
Yeah, we see her on a regular basis. You know, she's continued to do some great work in the community, a lot of community organizing. I was on a panel with her in Los Angeles just last weekend, And so we spent a little bit of time together. But it seems, you know, Dolores is a woman who has tremendous energy. She's always on the go. And it seems like we pass each other at different events and we say hi. But yeah, but, you know, she's lived a life of activism, that's for sure.
You live in Keene to this day. It's about a half hour outside of Bakersfield in Kern County, the Tehachapi Mountains, and you head the Cesar Chavez Foundation. Was that simply a natural, logical path to carry on your father's legacy?
Well, you know, for many years before I started doing this work in the foundation, I worked with the UFW. At one time, I thought I wanted to be an attorney, and I was going to, you know, go out and get my law degree and come back and practice law for the farm workers. And our general counsel at the time urged me to get involved in on the political side of the organization, on the programmatic side. And so I did different things. I worked in my father's office as an aide to the nonprofits that are part of the farm worker movement. And I later became a union negotiator and ran field offices. And I was the political director in Sacramento and Washington for a while. But it was early 91. That he asked me to come over to what is now the Cesar Chavez Foundation and give it a reason for existing. At that time, the nonprofit had done a lot of different things, but it was kind of a hodgepodge of different programs. And so what we did was we sat down and we worked hard. And since that time, we've built an organization that addresses four programmatic areas. We do affordable housing throughout the Southwest. We have our educational program that looks to bridge and to bridge the educational divide that exists with children of color, and then, you know, we have our communications program. I'm talking to you today from Phoenix, where we have our network facility for Radio Campesina, and then we have the work of the National Chavez Center that looks to use his legacy to inspire people to go out and be of service to the community and to look for ways to keep it relevant in today's world.
I mean, your father is known for activism and for nonviolence, but for protests and demonstrations. Where does that, your father's work, fit in today with these challenges?
The work of the Cesar Chavez Foundation, our core purpose is to inspire and transform communities. But we also understand that inspiration and hope is an important part of our work, that we get people to believe in themselves and to understand that they have a role to play in today's society. And so we use my father's example to inspire people to go out and be active in their communities, whether it's organizing farm workers or doing community cleanups. The idea is that we all have a contribution to make, and we also, all of us, have a responsibility to be part of that change to improve our communities. And so we see our work as twofold. You know, you got to go out and you got to organize, and you got to build affordable housing, and you got to do educational radio that uplifts and inspires but moves people to action. And we got to go out and we got to work with children and give them the skills needed for the 21st century economy so that they're fully prepared to partake in that. And so those are some of the things that we look at on a daily basis. And that's kind of how we approach our work.
If people make the trip to Kern County, they can visit the Cesar Chavez National Monument. You played a significant role in this monument. It was created, I believe, more than a decade ago. What kind of work goes into getting this level of recognition?
When my father passed away, my mother came to us and she said, you know, we didn't expect it. My father died when he was 66 years old. You know, my grandparents, his parents were 101 and 99 years of age. My dad was a vegetarian. He did yoga. And so we figured he'd be here forever. And so when he passed away, we were all surprised. And I remember my mother coming to us and saying, your father's wish was to be buried in Keene in La Paz, the headquarters. But she says, but I'm not going to do that unless you promise me we're never going to leave this place, because I won't leave him alone. And so we said, of course. And so, you know, and so after we said, of course, we sat down and we took a look at what we had, and we realized that that people would be coming to visit him and to, you know, to pay the respects, but also to recommit themselves to his work. And so after a number of years, we built a visitor center and a memorial grounds. And it was, and that was done in the early 2000s. Well, it was about 10 years ago that President Obama came to La Paz, to Keene, to establish a national monument. So, you know, our idea was originally to have a place that honors life and legacy, but you know, we were approached by the Obama administration with Secretary Ken Salazar, who said that, you know, that he thought that by establishing a national monument that it would elevate my father's story, and it would take it beyond being the story of farm workers and the labor movement to a part of national history. And so, you know, we thought about it, and we thought that was a good idea. We think that his life and the lessons learned from this movement is something that should be shared with people from all walks of life in this country. And so we agreed to donate about 3 acres of land to the federal government, and the president came came to establish the Cesar Chavez National Monument.
Well, President Obama also did. He proclaimed Cesar Chavez Day back in 2014. What did that moment of recognition mean for your family? 8 children, and I would imagine a couple dozen, if not more, grandchildren.
Oh, like a lot of grandchildren. You know, first of all, we're honored for that type of recognition. You know, a lot of people don't know, my father was never invited to the White House during his life. And so the fact that the day was established meant a lot to us. It was a long time in coming. We're happy about it, but we also understand that his legacy's got to be more than proclamations and names and national monuments. That if we do that in addition to continuing to organize and to help those most in need, then we honor his legacy in the way that he would be most proud of. And so we're very we're very grateful. But we also acknowledge that, you know, that we need to continue to do this work, because there's a lot of people that continue to work in difficult conditions and who are not receiving the respect that they deserve.
Well, on that note, how should we all honor your father's birthday?
You know, I remember when California established a holiday. There was a folks, especially our friends in the Latino caucus, that wanted a full-blown day off for kids, and because they, you know, they felt that my father deserved that, and we were very grateful for that sentiment. But I remember talking to my mom about it, and she says, you know, I don't think kids need another day out of school. I think what they need is they need to go get active in their communities. And so it was upon that urging, we sat down and we said, why don't we make Cesar Chavez a day of service? Kids go to school half a day, and then they can learn about his life, and maybe they can get involved in acts of service. And so for us, we think that the best way to honor his legacy is going out and being of service to your community. Lord knows that there is no shortage of problems that we face. And I think that if we go out and we do our part to make things better, a little bit better than we found them, then we honor his legacy, and, you know, in a way that's fitting, but also ensures that his legacy continues to help people for many years to come.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
And that is Paul Chavez, the son of the late civil rights activist Cesar Chavez, who heads the Cesar Chavez Foundation in Kern County. Still ahead, the Stockton Symphony joins us with a preview of In Tune with Justice, honoring the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, simply put, a legend, a petite yet powerful woman who fought against sexism, fought for equal rights, and was and still is a role model for women all across the nation. The former Supreme Court Justice passed away in September of 2020 at the age of 87. This weekend in Stockton, there will be a very special performance at the San Joaquin Delta College dedicated to Ginsburg. It's a mix of music, narration, and poetry. The Stockton Symphony presents a world premiere of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in tune with justice. The performance celebrates the remarkable achievements of Ginsburg as a trailblazing Supreme Court justice. Joining us to share more about what to expect this weekend are Peter Jaffe, the music director and conductor of the Stockton Symphony, as well as Victoria Bond, who is the composer and conductor of In Tune with Justice. It is a pleasure to have both of you on Insight today. Welcome, Victoria and Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting us. It's really great to be here. And actually, Vicky, it's a pair of performances. And so if you can't make it on one day, you can come to the other. So we've got a Saturday evening performance at 7 p.m. and a Sunday matinee at 2:30. And just as you said, this world premiere is really the centerpiece of this program. And we've got our composer right here. We flew her out from New York. We've got Victoria Bond here.
What makes
and in this case, I'm just here as composer. Peter is actually going to be conducting my work.
Oh, that's great. What makes it a world premiere, Peter?
Oh, well, that's simple. It's never been done before. when you give a performance for the very first time, it's a world premiere. And so Victoria and I have known each other for decades. You know, we've been fellow guest faculty members at a conducting institute in South Carolina. And so we've sat next to each other coaching a bunch of wannabe conductors. But she is not only a conductor, she's an excellent composer. And it's kind of like, I would imagine all this time she was thinking, Peter, when are you going to do one of my pieces? And we're finally doing it.
And we are now here. Victoria, explain how and why you came up with In Tune with Justice. What does it mean to you?
Well, I find Ruth Bader Ginsburg, first of all, to be a very inspiring person. And originally, when Peter and I had talked about collaborating on a work and a commission, it was going to be another piece. But then when Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, it was, you know, I really would like to do something to honor her memory. And the connection with music is a natural because she was an avid opera goer. And so, you know, it just seemed like a piece that was made for a situation, I should say, that was made for music.
Where did you find the inspiration, given that this hasn't been done before?
That is easy. I mean, her words are, first of all, I must say that Jane Viall Jaffe was the one who came up with the script because, interestingly enough, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as a judge, her words are very factual, but her life was full of drama. And that didn't come into her actual direct quotes. So Jane crafted a fabulous script that gives all of the drama of the struggles that she went through. I mean, all of us as women, and as mutual Vicky Victorias, I must say, that the kind of struggles that we all have gone through and that she had to go through being of another generation are full of drama.
Yeah.
And so obviously it's wonderful that we're doing a piece where my wife crafted the narration.
Of course. Yeah.
What a proud moment. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's listen to a song that inspired you, Victoria. This is Soul of a Nation. Let's take a listen.
Clip is, because if we're going to hear a world premiere, we can't possibly bring a clip of what we're going to hear to your studio because it has never been recorded before. So that's actually a sample of a beautiful piece Victoria wrote, another narrational piece.
Yeah, and you were cut off when the music was playing. So, but yeah, Victoria, I was just curious when it comes to Soul of a Nation. It's not going to be part of this weekend. But what resonated with you in terms of inspiration?
I wrote that piece, and it's about Thomas Jefferson, and I like the form of narration plus music. The famous Lincoln portrait of Aaron Copland was actually the first piece that both Peter and I have conducted many times. And I think the idea of spoken rather than sung words means that those words can really be understood. And so it's a form that I like a lot. And I've done a number of pieces using that form. And so with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that obviously seemed to me the best way to bring her words and the underlying emotions. So the music and the words have a different role to play, but they're complementary.
And Victoria has been so smart about the way she crafted this piece. She's built in the flexibility and even some vamp passages because it's designed to have a narrator that might not know how to read music. Mm. You know, when you do one of these pieces like the Lincoln Portrait or Victoria's world premiere, you never know whether the person is going to have, you don't, it shouldn't be a prerequisite. And so she's so smart about the flexibility that she's built in. And we're working with Stockton's poet laureate, Tama Brisbane.
Yeah, that is incredible. Tell us about that collaboration, Peter.
Tama has an organization called With Our Words that she founded many, many years ago. And Stockton has a couple of times gone to the East Coast and competed for a title called All American City. And back in 2015, Tama took a group of people, including Brandon Leak, the big spoken word star of America's Got Talent recently, and they went there with this spoken word presentation, and that helped win the award. And Tama and I have worked on a bunch of projects together, and so it's just so cool to have her be the narrator for this world premiere.
Yeah. We're going to play another clip. Even if people don't go to the opera, I think a lot of people are familiar with the next clip we're going to listen to. See, everyone's bouncing around in the audio booth right now.
I hope so. Yeah. So that was the overture to Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro, and it was actually Ruth Bader Ginsburg's favorite opera. And Victoria is such a genius at taking ingredients and repurposing them. I mean, think about the great food shows where they tell you, take all these ingredients and make them into something different. Maybe you want to talk about
that. Yeah, sure. Well, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the films about her, had a mischievous sense of humor, and there's was a tremendous liveliness to her. And so not only was Mozart's Marriage of Figaro one of her favorite operas, but the spirit of the overture, I felt, captured that liveliness and that mischievousness of her character. So I wanted to use those emotions plus a little fragments of some patriotic America the Beautiful and the Star-Spangled Banner, and to sort of throw all of these, as Peter says, cooking ingredients into the stew. And what came out? Well, you'll have to hear for yourself.
It sounds pretty yummy. Victoria, I can't ignore the timeliness of this. I mean, we're in the middle of a confirmation process for another Supreme Court justice, which, if confirmed, would be historic. I mean, does that make this weekend's performances any more special to you? And if so, why?
Well, it's absolutely fortuitous circumstances. We could not have planned this.
Yeah, we had no idea when we planned this project that this would be the case.
But it's so timely. It's absolutely perfect. And, you know, it's art imitating life, imitating art. There's a circle that goes around. And so we're particularly happy that these circumstances have come together at this time.
Yeah.
The other thing that's fascinating about Ruth Bader Ginsburg being an opera fan is that her opera buddy was Antonin Scalia. Mm-hmm. And so you've got two Supreme Court justices. I mean, we all think that in an ideal world, the Supreme Court should not be politicized. You know, justice should not be political. But quite frankly, they were at opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. And yet they overcame that in their mutual love of opera. And they would go to operas together. And they were even cast as supernumeraries in an opera production. And it's that kind of civility and public discourse that I think we need more of today, that you can have one of your best friends be somebody that you're at the opposite ends of the spectrum from.
Yeah, they even traveled together. I remember seeing some photos of them on vacation with each other.
Yeah. And of course, it's a no-brainer, right? If an inspiration for Victoria was the Overture to Mera Figaro, we are opening that program with that piece.
Oh, that's great. You also have a special tribute planned at the beginning of the performance, acknowledging what's happening around the world.
That is absolutely right. I'm glad you brought that up. We have added to the very beginning of each of these performances the Ukrainian national anthem. And it's a really heartfelt moment where we're paying tribute to all the people who are, quite frankly, just struggling for survival right now.
Yeah. Going beyond In Tune with Justice, which there are two performances people can take in Saturday and Sunday. Peter, what more is being planned at Stockton Symphony? What's on the calendar this year?
We also have in May a tribute to our local hero astronaut, Jose Hernandez. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be kind of like This Is Your Life with music. And that's going to be on May 15th. But if we can rewind to the current weekend for just a minute, not only have we got Victoria's premiere and pieces of music on that program, but we're featuring youth and their inspiration. And so we have middle school kids, high school kids who have been inspired to write poetry or to create visual artwork. And they were coached by the poet laureate Tama Brisbane. And so that's going to be on stage right in the middle of the program, right before we hear Victoria's premiere.
Oh, that's...
And then the end of that program has Stravinsky's Firebird Suite. And so it's just a program for something for everybody.
Yeah, really. I mean, it sounds wonderful. I guess my last question for the both of you is, how do you want people to feel when they leave?
Uplifted.
Inspired. The idea of hope and coming back to our values as a nation.
And again, with the person of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, somebody who had so many negative barbs thrown at her, and who is able to not only survive them, but to overcome them and to bring us all a message of empowerment.
Yeah. One of the final things in the narration in this piece is RBG talking about how she was inspired by youth and the hope for the future. And that's why we've brought that young talent right onto the stage right before we play Victoria's piece.
It's sort of the Olympic relay of, you know, her ideas of inspiration being passed on to another generation.
Yeah, it's not only looking at her accomplishments on the court, but who she was as a person outside of the Supreme Court.
Exactly.
And I would also imagine, given that we've been 2 years into a pandemic and creativity, there's been a drought of it. I mean, it's coming back. It's being revitalized. That probably takes on a deeper level of meaning and appreciation.
Well, all of us as professional musicians have suffered over these past 2 years because we really haven't been able to have live performances. So the fact that this orchestra is going to be live on stage with a live audience is a really big deal.
I got to tell you, you know, these performances we've been able to, you know, resurrect ourselves with the Stockton Symphony, it's been a real love fest, you know, with the players on the stage and us getting to reconnect with the audience, because that's our mission. If we can't connect with an audience and make them feel these wonderful things, our life is not complete.
Yeah.
And I think everybody realizes now, with all the virtual performances that we've seen in the past 2 years, it's just not the same watching it on your computer screen as it is to actually be there experiencing it with other people, with live musicians in the moment.
It's what we live for.
Yep.
Amen.
Peter and Victoria, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Peter Jaffe and Victoria Bond. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's In Tune with Justice performs Saturday and Sunday at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. You are listening to Firebird, which will be playing at San Joaquin Delta College for this performance. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez, Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer, and I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.